I think that's the most exciting thing Mike has ever done.
Welcome to the first ever Linux Voice podcast. This is Linux Voice, Season 1, Episode 1. Remember where you were when you heard this. This is the beginning of a new age, and I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
And I'm Nick Veach.
And we don't have Mike Saunders with us, but hopefully over the course of the next 45 minutes or so, we'll be able to somehow psychically transfer some sound files from him, and he can tell us what he's been up to all this time. Still to come, we have the news. We have things we've discovered in 14 days. We have the challenge, and we have vocalise your neurons, plus the awe-inspiring voice of the masses. That brings us to the news then, I suppose.
The news. Well, first up this fortnight, you may not have heard, it's been quite quiet, but some people have launched a new Linux magazine, apparently.
Wow, that's yeah. Great.
It's us. We've left Linux format, we're starting Linux Voice, which is going to be awesome.
Aren't print magazines dead, though?
Print magazines aren't dead.
I think that is... Now, I know you asked that in a facetious tone of voice, as is your usual wont, but print magazines, the generalist print magazines, such as Loaded or Cosmopolitan, those that try and reach a very wide audience, they are dying. They're dying a terrible, slow death quite quickly. But the niche magazines, the specialist magazines, such as Private Eye, which I greatly admire, are actually doing really well.
Or indeed Classic Land Rover.
Classic Land Rover, yes. I believe posted an ABC increase in its circulation this year, did it not? Private Eye certainly did, anyway.
Yeah.
Yes. The Spectator, all of those. And indeed last year, Linux Format sold more than it did the year before. So Prince is still alive and doing well. Ben, what else have you got to tell us about this exciting new magazine launch?
Well, it's being done by us, in case you didn't know. So it's being launched on Indiegogo, so we're raising funds to start it hopefully in the early part of next year. It's going to be awesome for loads of reasons, but to start with...
Well, the first reason, and in my opinion the most awesome reason, is that we're going to give 50% of all our profits back to the Linux and free software community. That's back to developers, back to projects, back to events... We've been speaking to a big bunch of people, but we can't exactly promise who we're going to give the money to yet, because we're going to let the readers decide. We're going to have some sort of voting system. Obviously in the first year profits will be quite slim, but in the second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh and eighth and ninth and tenth years, we hope to make lots of money and divert that back to the good causes, back to the community, and try and sustain it and bring more software to the masses.
That sounds awesome. And to continue with the socially responsible vibe, we're also going to make all the content available under a Creative Commons license 9 months after publication, which means that, you know, people can build upon this stuff, people can share it, people can do what they want with it. They can use it for teaching, they can use it for learning, they can make it more awesome. But we can only release this awesome new magazine with your support. So we've launched a crowdfunder on Indiegogo. If you haven't already, pop over there, take a look at the video. You can hear more about us talking about it. And if you think it's a good idea like we do, you can help us do it by buying a subscription to it. And if you have already supported, firstly, you're awesome. And secondly, help get the word out. Let people know that you've supported it and you think it's a good idea. But moving on to some non-us related news.
The less awesome news.
The less awesome news. Debian 8 is going to switch to XFCE, probably. Dropping GNOME as its default.
What's wrong with Unity?
I don't know. I actually used Unity for quite a while and quite liked it. However, I may be one of only three people in the world that did.
That's Let's interrupt this podcast halfway through the news section to explain it, who Nick Veitch is. Nick Veitch.
Someone explain it to me.
Nick Veitch, the man sitting to my right, gave us a choice when we came round to his house to record the podcast. He said he could either tidy up or make some biscuits. And there are three biscuits left and three of us in the room. So that's a nice round coincidence. Nick also, Nick launched Linux Format. He was the first editor. He created it. He was arguably, one might say, the visionary behind it, although there are other senior editors at Future Who.
Yeah, I think during the 5 weeks that I had to launch that particular title, I don't actually remember seeing any of those other people. Just remember seeing a computer and some empty desks. Anyway.
And Nick left some time ago to work for Canonical.
Yay!
Hooray for Canonical! So where were we?
So yeah, Debian going to XFCE, obviously turning its nose up at GNOME and other alternatives.
Well, it's good that it's sticking with GTK, obviously. So all of the stock applications and the themes and all of that will still work. It'll still look like Debian.
Yeah. I think that if you're using Debian, you've probably already picked what desktop environment you're going to use and not just go with the default.
Yes. Yeah. Debian is... provides an awesome base upon which others can piggyback and claim all the credit.
I'm sure some people do.
So yeah, that's I think some people are trying to read into this more than it is. It's not the announcement of the decline of GNOME. It's just one distro sticking with something that's visually more similar to how it used to be.
Yes.
Or one more distro, because there have been several over the years. But like you say, I mean, you know, people who can install Debian can choose whatever window manager, whatever desktops they like, and I'm all for choice.
And that is, of course, one of the awesome things about Debian, is that there are so many packages, so many repositories, and apt-get makes it so easy. Even I can manage to install stuff on the command line in Debian.
Yeah. Next up in our news list, there's been a bit of a spat between Ubuntu and Mint about security updates. Nick, would you like to enlighten us about this?
I'm not. I haven't read all the comments that have been made on it. I can only tell you what my understanding of it is. Mint by default doesn't enable all security updates on the software, and someone casually mentioned that they thought this wasn't a particularly secure way of going about doing things. If a package has a security vulnerability and the developers of that software respond appropriately by releasing an update for it, then users should probably have the option to install that automatically if they want, which, to be fair, they do. It's just turned off unless you configure various settings on Mint. That's all I can really tell you about that story. I don't use Mint myself.
Yeah, I mean, this sort of thing's come up a few times before. I mean, most probably famously with CentOS, not necessarily holding back, but there being a delay in security updates getting into it from Red Hat. Now, I believe it's much shorter than it used to be with CentOS, and it sort of caused a bit of a news with Manjaro as well, holding back some delays from Arch. And there's always a sort of trade-off between whether or not you spend time to properly, you know, test the stability of the patches that come in. And for everyone, there's obviously going to be a different balance. If you're running some top high security servers, you run out on the day. If it's on your desktop, I mean, I don't install updates every week. Mm. I'm probably a few weeks behind.
If you're that paranoid about security, you wouldn't connect your computer to the internet. So
you'd be running macOS.
Yes.
The most secure of all distributions, operating systems.
Yeah. I think our general consensus is that it's not a big deal, really. Unless you're running top security stuff, in which case Mint probably isn't the best choice anyway. Next up in the news, Raspberry Pi sales hit 2 million. 2 million!
Wow.
That's a lot.
Das ist fantastisch.
Yeah.
That's Welsh for that's fantastic, isn't it?
I think so.
It just seems like 2 minutes ago that they were announcing sales of 1.3 million and 1 million of which were made in Wales. To have jumped to 2 million seemingly in the last couple of months is just incredible.
Well, in their update, they said they were expecting it to happen February, March time. And then they just got this email through from the distributor saying, whoa, we've just sold 2 million. And they were like, what? So it apparently came as a shock to them as well.
Maybe the distributor is very poor at counting, or maybe they got some big orders through. I know that there were quite a lot of educational establishments who were interested in rolling out pie-related programs. So.
I think it's also starting to be incorporated in other products. I've seen certainly some Kickstarters and some commercial products that are building upon the Raspberry Pi.
Right.
I think it's being used quite a lot in digital signage as well. Not necessarily quite a lot, but it's starting to be used there.
That is super cool.
Yeah.
I imagine if you're a local education authority, you don't buy just one Raspberry Pi, do you? You buy however many thousand.
Yeah, I've also heard that in some universities, they're just being given out to all computer science students when you know, first day of term, first year, have a Raspberry Pi.
Awesome. That's brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, you'd expect something like that for the several thousand tuition fees. Doesn't seem like a big...
No. No, I really like the Raspberry Pi, but what I found is that there aren't that many really good books on the market about how to learn to program with it.
Someone should sort that out.
Yeah.
I'll make a note. I'll... entirely coincidentally, my book, Programming the Raspberry Pi, Learning Python with the Raspberry Pi, I think it's called, is available to pre-order on Amazon.
You think it's cool.
What's the name of that book again?
I'm actually not completely sure. It's either Learning the Raspberry Pi with Python or Learning Python with the Raspberry Pi.
I'm sure the same rigorous attention to detail has gone into every page.
Well, the title, some marketing person came up with that. I did the bit between the covers. Someone else did the covers. More news, shifting back towards your employer, Nick. Ubuntu 14.04.
Is it good news?
That depends on your point of view, I think. Apparently, 14.04, the next LTS release, isn't going to have Mir.
Okay.
is that good news?
That's quite an interesting question. I don't know if that's good news or not. Some people definitely think it's good news.
This surely is just Canonical is damned if it doesn't, damned if it doesn't. You know, they announce that they're going to try and do something new. They think that there's something wrong with X, that it's crufty, that there's loads of old 70s code in there that he's getting rid of. And then, you know, they miss an internal deadline or something. Rather than foist unready stuff on us, they say, oh, it's not ready yet, so we're going to hold it back. And suddenly they've failed, and oh no, Canonical is rubbish. But if they did the opposite, if they developed behind closed doors and just released it as a fait accompli, then, you know, they'd get the same amount of criticism for being secretive and evil.
I think pushing the first version out into an LTS release would have been very bold. They'd had to be very confident in it to do that.
Is bold a euphemism for stupid?
Possibly.
Well, I mean, all I can say is I know some of the people that are working on that project, and yeah, like anything else, we wouldn't push anything out until it was ready, because that would be foolish.
And plus, with the 6 month, if this were Debian, if Canonical were Debian, if Ubuntu were Debian, sorry, then they'd just delay it and wait for as long as it took until it was ready. Whereas they have a strict six month release cycle, which is one of the strengths of Ubuntu, because it's predictable and you know when the update's going to come.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's well said.
Thanks for that brown envelope. Oh, look, pink ones.
Other distributions are available. Like OpenSUSE, which has just released 13.1.
Yast, evil Yast. I will have no part of this.
Yast was my first ever knowing of Linux, really. Well, the first time I ever booted up, that's what I used to install Yast 2, probably.
These youngsters today.
It's brilliant. And I think there are some really great features about OpenSUSE. The one-click installs on the web is done really well. And I know there is a similar feature in Ubuntu, but I think OpenSUSE do it better because there you can do all sorts of funky repository stuff as well, rather than just installing a single thing.
You can, but there are too many options in Yast.
There are.
It's too confusing. It doesn't make any sense. If you've been brought up speaking German as a first language and your idea of grammar is to shovel a load of words in and put a verb at the end, then quite possibly Yast may make sense. But to my more free-flowing mind, Yast is just full of fail.
I've always assumed, I've never used it this way, that Yast is really designed for sysadmins running 10, 100, 200 desktops, and they can do their jazz in Yast and just bosh.
Are you confused by the multiplicity of options that you have?
I generally just like fewer options. Yes, yeah. I've always been a fan of XFCE and GNOME. In later years, Unity for the, you know, just give me what I want and don't, you know, don't confuse me with all this KDE babble.
Well, I think you just underline the reason why there are various distributions.
Because, yes, of course.
Because people have different ideas about how they want to work. And if you want a confusing, slightly Germanic installer, then obviously you would go for SUSE.
And if you want a confusing American installer, you go for Fedora.
And, yeah, I don't know why anyone goes for MicOS. But,
And that's the news.
That pleasant cornucopia of new stuff brings us hurtling headforth into discoveries of the things we found in a fortnight. Who's found something out this fortnight?
I have.
Don't be shy, Nick. It's okay.
I've discovered lots of things. I suppose you want me to narrow the field to Linux-related things.
Not necessarily. I mean, often many months go by, which I don't discover anything to do with Linux.
I discovered some bad things, which led me to discover quite a nice thing.
A narrative arc, yeah, that's good.
Now I've spoiled it all by telling you that in advance. But anyway, my son decided that after a recent trip to Ireland, he discovered there were lots of places called Bally This and Bally That, and he really wanted to have a sign outside our house that said Bally Monkey on it, meaning the place of monkey. And I thought this was a reasonable request. So I set about making a sign, and I thought, well, in this modern age, I should really, instead of buying some cheap letters and cobbling together a sign, I should like make a nice sign and have it 3D printed. And that would be fantastic. Now, if only I could find some 3D software that I could put some words in and make a nice 3D object to upload to the 3D printer. So I loaded up Blender, and then I shut down Blender, and then I looked at various other 3D tools for Linux, some of which were very good. I looked at some CAD tools as well, like FreeCAD and OpenCAD and various other CADs. Just simply to try and find something that I could create a nice object in out of some text. And it was insanely difficult because the modeling software, which was actually usable and quite good at making models, didn't have any text functionality in it. And the things which did have text functionality in either didn't export in any sensible way or were Blender. And someone recently told me, gosh, I can't remember what his name was, that he'd found Blender to be quite useful, and after spending several weeks of intently plugging away at it, he actually understood a small amount of it. So I did go back into Blender, and I did follow some tutorials that I discovered on YouTube, and they were very good. Unfortunately, the interface had gone through about six different iterations since the tutorial was made, so none of the magic buttons that the person clicked on actually were in Blender anymore. But eventually I did manage to make a Bally Monkey sign in Blender, but it was very difficult. So my discovery is really that 3D is still quite difficult because you still sort of have to use Blender if you want to do anything useful. And I think it's sort of interesting. It reminds me of a few years ago, I remember writing about something in some magazine, some Linux magazine, about when you have one predominant open source software project that is so strong that it eclipses all the others.
Yes.
And this was notably the case with GIMP. It didn't matter how bad GIMP got or how out of date it got, because it was such a dominant graphics package that everybody would use it, and no one would think about starting up another project.
Or even adding something like CMYK support.
Or even doing something like that, yes. So it's sort of interesting in open source, where there's no real barrier to entry for anyone to come along and make their own project. There still are some barriers when you have projects which are slowed down by their own immense nature and can't add features or even update themselves as quickly as they like. And I know, part of the problem with GIMP was that it's very complicated software, and they simply didn't have enough developers working on it for a lot of the time. I'm pleased to say it's a lot better now. But the happy thing that I found anyway was whilst I was looking at useless tools or differently useful tools in Linux, I rediscovered a little program called TreeD, which makes little 3D trees. And watching little fractal trees be generated in 3D calmed me and helped me to pursue my goal of making a Bally Monkey sign.
I think you could say that 3D was an Irish 3D to make your Bally Monkey sign with. Did you do it bilingual with the game? Why not? Was there no European Union funds available to you to make it bilingual?
Oh dear.
What did you do with the 3D model? Did you upload it to some website?
I uploaded it to Shapeway, which I don't know if anyone knows about. I think
no.
Shapeway is an excellent idea. It's a centralized service for printing objects in 3D. You upload your object to them, they collect together a whole load of objects and then send them to specialist people who create in a giant batch lots of 3D objects, and then they send them to you via courier. So it's a bit cheaper than building your own 3D printer and it only takes a couple of weeks, and they amazingly, what's great about Shapeway, it used to just be the usual sort of standard plastic shapes, but now they've developed the service a bit further, so you can print in all sorts of materials, even metals and things like that. It's really interesting. What they do is they print it out in wax or something first, and then make a mold, and then cast an object in metal. So you can create something. It's relatively inexpensive.
I did wonder about how you would 3D print in metal.
It has been done in like solder and stuff.
Mm. In solder, yeah.
You could do it. I think I've also seen a 3D printer that worked with sand, which was quite impressive. You took it to the beach and it made. Instead of having to make your unicorn on a wave or whatever it is that people sculpt at Western Supermare, you just set up this printer and load it up with sand and a bit of water, and it would print it in 3D for you.
I don't know if that's the best way of making a sandcastle or something just ruining your childhood.
It's entirely joyless.
Yeah.
Ben, have you discovered anything?
My discoveries. I've got two discoveries, and I'm a little bit unsure about the first one, but I've discovered it. So
you shared a discovery of rage with us on the way over, didn't you?
Did I?
The thing with the thing, with the Raspberry Pi, with Python.
Yeah.
Have I just preempted a discovery? A thing that you found in a fortnight?
I haven't investigated it enough, though.
All right, cool.
There's a slight possibility I was being incredibly stupid in some way. But I'm pretty sure I wasn't.
Okay, well, let's insure against stupidity by leaving it for another 2 weeks.
So, yeah, my discoveries this week. This one, yeah, as I said, I'm a bit unsure about because some people have bad-mouthed it, but I discovered it, so I'll say it. It's Evozy. It's for those of you using CyanogenMod who don't want to install Google apps of dubious legality, like the Play Store, the Play Marketplace, whatever they're calling it. It's a way of getting APKs off the Play Store in a dubiously legal fashion. It's a website where you enter the name of the app and it gives you just the install file for anything on Google Play. I assume only the free apps. I don't think you can get the paid for ones. And it works. I've managed to get the 4OD thing so I can watch telly on my CyanogenMod tablet, which is quite handy. As I said, it's a bit dubious because it's based on a Chrome extension, and the developer of the Chrome extension has made some wild claims that this web app is malware. He hasn't backed up this in any way. He just went, "Whoa, spyware, don't use it." And it seems to be that he's a bit upset because they haven't released the web app under open source when his app that it's based on was GPL'd. Which is an awkward situation because it's a web app, it's not distributing it, and he didn't license it under the AGPL, but under the GPL. So they're not technically required to release the source code, although many people would argue they do have a moral responsibility to. So, and also, he made no backup of the claim that it had malware on it. So, use with caution, but it seems to be working for me. And the second discovery is also actually on getting around Google stuff. Well, not actually, yeah. I'll tell you, on DuckDuckGo, the search engine, if you put exclamation mark man space, it then does a search of the man pages. So, yeah, so you could just do on the terminal type man, but you get it in nice, pretty graphics rather than in monospaced font.
And you can scroll to the relevant bit of the man page, which is always just right at the bottom with your mouse, rather than having to click into a separate window and use the cursor keys.
Yes. So those are my discoveries.
Excellent. Good discoveries, Ben.
Thanks.
That leaves my discoveries to come. I've discovered a plethora of things. I found where the sanctuary is. This is something that's always bugged me. Yesterday I had the morning off from being the editorial director of Linux Voice, coordinating a multinational, multi-time zoned campaign to raise funds on our Indiegogo page. And went off to Avebury, which is this fantastic Neolithic site in Wiltshire. It's 14. The stone circle at Avebury is 14 times bigger than Stonehenge, and it's 500 years older. So, and it's so much cooler as well. There's such a lot of stuff there. So I must recommend anybody interested in pseudo Celtic Druidism to give Stonehenge and its overpriced visitor centre a miss and go instead to Avebury, which is free to visit and has a pub.
You have to pay to go to Stonehenge?
You have to pay to get into Stonehenge, yeah. Oh,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh. That's not what the Druids would have wanted.
No.
I don't know. Maybe the Druids did.
Maybe the Druids did. We don't know. Let's spend millions of pounds building an interpretive centre so we can say in all sorts of multimedia that we don't know what Stonehenge is. That's a great use of public money. Yeah. So Avebury is utterly fantastic, and I found the sanctuary, which is just a load of post holes in the ground. It's nothing much to look at, but you get a great view from up there. All the stones, or the little wisps of smoke from the thatched cottages.
Did you see the stone that fell on the dentist?
Yes, I did.
What a silly man.
Yes, in the olden days, in the 13-somethings.
Somewhere around there.
It was decided by the church authorities that these were a sign of devil worship and evil and had to be knocked down. And somebody unfortunately got squashed underneath one of the stones while he was doing so. So that's a non-Linux discovery. Other discoveries are IRC. IRC, I can't believe I've come so late to IRC. It's really useful, a really useful way of chatting. And I mentioned this to a couple of people who I used to work with, and they scoffed and said, "What? So that's so 80s. Why are you still using IRC?" And it turned out that people at one of the world's biggest Linux and open source companies use IRC, don't they, Nick?
Do they? Which company are you referring to there?
I don't know, the name escapes me. And there's Mumble, which I've discovered, which is a bit like IRC, but for sound. So you all take turns to talk, and it all works in real time. I found that out last night when I took part in the Tux Jam podcast with Kevy and Andrew, who is also known as McNallu. And we spoke about all sorts of Linux-related stuff on there and listened to some cool Creative Commons music.
IRC is brilliant. You can do all sorts of things on IRC as well that most people don't know about, like exchange files and things. And for me, the beauty of IRC is that basically anywhere in the world you are with a damp piece of string for a connection, it's about the one service you can rely on actually working if you actually need to communicate with someone, which is I guess one reason for its enduring popularity. There are loads of brilliant channels, particularly on Freenode, which I think is probably the most popular server for IRC. Loads of brilliant channels. You always find people on any time of day or night from all around the world in your own particular interest group. There are loads of Ubuntu channels, I believe, on there as well.
For the niche interest groups.
Yes.
My final discovery comes from 2 weeks ago. My final thing that I found comes from 2 weeks ago. And that is that Lord Chief Justice Thomas, I think his name is that, but he's the most senior judge in England and Wales. He thinks that the judicial system can save time and money, not by licensing more lawyers to practice, or by possibly paying lawyers less, or by organising the police so that they actually bring all of their evidence on time to the right place. But he thinks we can save money in the judicial system by allowing defendants and witnesses to give their evidence via FaceTime and Skype.
Is this because the NSA isn't collecting enough data about the British judicial system?
Exactly. What? The level of what we need is some sort of magazine that gives 50% of its profits back to promoting the cause of open source and letting people know why this is such a damn stupid idea.
Was it just FaceTime and Skype, or were other?
He said, well, those were the ones that he mentioned by name. He said that you can do great things with Skype. We need to open up to use FaceTime. So he was using his platform to plug Apple.
It seems wrong to mention specific services, but
closed source services where all of the encryption in this, you know, obviously justice is open, but I don't want it to go through Apple servers. there are limits to how to openness.
Are you concerned that Apple may filter out statements that they disagree with?
Possibly, or there could be some sort of backdoor or bug that Apple thinks, oh, you know, security by obscurity, and you can get into that, gain access to some sort of restricted evidence, which in some certain trials could be valuable. You could contact whatever mafia boss and say, oh, you know, I know what they're saying about you. Give me a few pounds.
I wonder if
bake me a few biscuits, and I'll give you a brief, an extra 24 hours to prepare.
No, it would be interesting to see if organised crime also jumped on this bandwagon and having received the hacked evidence, then called up the witnesses and threatened them via FaceTime as well.
Yes,
instead,
yes,
of,
yes.
Instead of having to go round to their house, it would make everything more efficient, wouldn't it?
Efficiency win, yes. Although my personal recommendation would be to license more, get the Bar Association to license more solicitors and more barristers, and that the laws of supply and demand would drive their wages down. All professions are a conspiracy against the laity, as somebody said once. And that's all the discoveries. That's all the things that we found in 2 weeks. That brings us to the halfway reminder. Still to come, there's Vocalize Your Neurons, brought to us live from Vienna. And there'll be the other thing, which is Voice of the Masses.
Yes.
Voice of the Masses.
And our challenge.
And the results of our challenge report. Last week we challenged ourselves to make a magazine.
How's that going?
It's going fairly well. We have 700 and, I believe, 60-odd backers as of the time of recording, which I sincerely hope will have gone up by the time this goes out. We've raised £39,365 in a week and a day, which is about 43% of our total, with 35 days left to go. So things are looking very, very positive. So I appear to be winning the challenge report. How about you, Ben?
I think I'm winning it as well.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I challenged myself to make some biscuits.
You've won.
Yes.
Because you've not made 43% of some biscuits. You've actually made some biscuits.
Though, to be fair, there is less than 43% left.
Oh, that's great. That brings the graph of challenges into three axes.
Someone's had more than one.
I've had more than one.
I've had more than one.
I know.
I can't remember how many there were. There are only three of us, aren't there?
And, yeah. did you must have made a multiple of three biscuits.
I can't remember
using your elite math skills. So that's the challenge report neatly dealt with. What now?
Challenge for the next. Do you want to do the challenge setting ourselves to use Crunchbang?
Oh, yeah. Awesome. Crunchbang are awesome, aren't they?
Yeah. Crunchbang is awesome. I seem to remember covering it in something or other. Some roundup I wrote years ago for some magazine saying that everyone should use it. Have you been using it?
I have. You're obviously an early adopter and therefore much cooler than I am. I've only just discovered IRC. But I tried Crunchbang 2 or 3 weeks ago. I spoke about it in a podcast that we did a while ago. And it's brilliant. It's really clear and clean. And it looks like it's going to be frightening because it's open box. And, ooh, open box, where are the icons? But it just works so well. And we've had some lovely, really heartwarming support from Philip Newbrough and the Crunchbang people. Thanks to all of you lot. You know who you are for supporting us on the Crunchbang page. And
so the Crunchbang team have put in an advert for Linux Voice on the default Crunchbang page, the landing page, and in the forums pages. Previously, it held a statement like, I think it was be excellent to each other, which is also really good advice. Massive thanks to the Crunchbang team, and they said they're going to continue doing this with other sort of good projects, so that's a really great gesture and we really appreciate it. We're going to be using Crunchbang for the next 2 weeks.
Now it's time for Voice of the Masses, but before we get on to that, I'm just going to remind you of our Indiegogo URL again, which is indiegogo.com/project/linux-voice. There are a few videos, at the moment all of which feature me, so that's great. And you can learn more about our aims and our values and our pricing tiers. And you can even subscribe and leave comments. Please leave comments, because we want to know what you think. And on that note of wanting to know what you think, it's time for Voice of the Masses. We posed a question, as we always do, and the question this fortnight was, who is the most important GNU/Linux/Floss person? So there are no time restrictions on this. It's not person of the year. It's just who is the most important person. And yes, the first response came from Gareth Thomas, who, now that he's retired from international rugby, is hanging about on our forums on the Next Voice. The sickening answer is the user. Without people using and spreading the software, there would be no community. Yes, and that's been a very popular response. It seems actually to have been split fairly equally between the user, Linus Torvalds, and Richard Stallman as the three most awesomest, influential, important people.
With quite a few people going for Bill Gates and Ballmer.
Yeah, Steve Ballmer.
Yeah. And I think it's been put tongue-in-cheek, but I think there is a serious element to it as well. I mean, every story needs a villain, and they have played that villain quite well.
That's true. The Bond film, Quantum of Solace, that had a rubbish baddie, and it was a rubbish film.
Yeah.
Whereas Le Chief...
Well, I think Ballmer is looking for new opportunities now, maybe.
Perfect henchman material. He's a big lad, bald head. Shouts a lot.
Can he throw a hat with blades on the rim?
Stallman's a good choice, though, isn't he? A lot of people don't know his history, but I'm not going to bore you with the story of his life. But it is very interesting if you look into how he came to be involved in free software. And, you know, he may be extreme in some of his ideas, but I think it's the way I always look at it is that I'm really glad there is a Stallman, because he believes very strongly in a lot of things, which means I don't have to all the time, because I know he's there believing in them for me.
Yeah.
And he has done some wonderful things. And all of them, I think, for me, the one thing that sort of stands out is the creation of the GPL. I mean, that is an absolute watershed moment for free software.
I agree completely. I think the GPL certainly is far more important than the HERD, although they're both recursive acronyms. Shimmy says, I think RMS is the most important individual, keeping our values in check and being a model for purism we can aspire to. Shimmy has posted twice, so I won't read it out again. Steve Ballmer says, ugly spud. Yggdrasil, California Penguin. I must say, actually, having been at the centre of a multinational, multi-continental, multi-time-zoned internet campaign for the last week and a bit, the internet is full of, well, Slashdot certainly, it's full of ill-thought-out, ignorant rantings. Linuxvoice.com, voice of the masses, is full of just great points and people disagreeing politely.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I thought I knew how it was going to go when we put the question up, and it didn't go. I thought it was just going to go into a rant fest, Linus versus RMS, but it actually hasn't. There's been some really, really, yeah, clever answers in there. People have thought about it.
One voice of RMS dissent comes from Burgess Meredith, who says, Tux Radar's last interview with Karen Sandler went much further in opening my eyes to the need of free and open source than a nutjob like RMS ever could. Yes, he created GNU, but he is a hippie lunatic. And I tend not to listen to hippie lunatics. No, I'm not anti-free software. I'm anti-Stallman.
That's a bit of a shame, because hippie lunatics have created most of the internet and most of the technology that went behind it.
The two comments that really made me think were the one about the founders of Red Hat, and about how they've pushed in the commercial side, and they really pioneered the concept of, you know, making money, but at the same time supporting the community, and they did a huge amount to push adoption in the commercial side. And the other one, I don't know if you want to go into that.
Yeah, that was Stephen Wheeler nominating Bob Young and Mark Ewing of the Red Hat founders.
And the second one was the guys who open source Netscape, because I think that's, it's kind of forgotten now, and it's kind of taken for granted that you can use any browser to access websites, but it came very close to not going that way. It, you know, the internet was very nearly an Internet Explorer only affair when that almost completely dominated the browser market share. And if that had happened, Microsoft could have just closed its grip on the internet. You know, if you and everything else would have been a secondary browser experience, you'd have needed ActiveX, etc., etc., and Firefox and Chrome and all the others just wouldn't be possible.
Yeah, I remember issue 66 of Linux Format had a feature about Firefox taking back the web.
Gosh, you have a good memory.
Who wrote that?
I believe the primary focus of that was an interview. With Blake Ross, was it?
Yes, it was.
He was one of the leading exponents of making things simpler and nicer and easier in browsers. It was a very interesting time and a fantastic issue. edited by someone who knew what they were doing.
Worked on by a team of writers who use Linux.
And nowadays it's not that revolutionary for a commercial company to release open source software, but at the time it completely was. It was breaking new ground. That it was more before Firefox, really, the creation of Mozilla, and that I think that was a real watershed moment again.
Yeah, there are a few wacky out there suggestions, or rather away from the trinity of the user, Stallman and Linus. Dale says that Aben Upton of the Raspberry Pi Foundation would have to be on the list as the new up-and-comer. I have used GNU Linux since 04, but since the release of the Raspberry Pi, I have really been learning the ins and outs of Linux and coding. This board makes tweaking and hacking stress-free since it is such a low-cost device, and when I show my friends, they think I am ace, and they have a lot of questions about GNU Linux and how it works. Questions which you can answer using programming the Raspberry Pi with Python or learning Python with the Raspberry Pi, we're not sure which, by some dudes.
It definitely starts with learning, and it's got Raspberry Pi and Python in the title.
Great stuff. Ugly Spud says, Steve Ballmer, I'm being serious. Without his histrionics and vitriol, I'd never have looked into this thing called Linux, and I'd probably still be using a hooky copy of Microsoft Windows 98 SE. Oof, blimey, that's harsh. California Penguin mentions Yggdrasil, which he thinks was the very first distro to publish Linux distros on CDs in around 1992. Modems were barely faster than smoke signals then, when Yggdrasil appeared. Truly a critical link in the Linux distribution chain.
Yes, it was. Named after some mythical Norse creature, I believe.
It's the tree of life.
Okay. Yes.
Its roots go down to the various planes of existence. Midgard, Niflheim, Asgard, Debian. Yes, all of those. That's the trouble with Nordic mythology. There's too much choice. It's like breakfast cereals. Sig3 says, Klaus Knopper's Nopix was crucial for the development of the live CD. I don't have statistics, but I'd bet the live CD brought Linux to a greater variety of people than install CDs. Yes.
I think that's really true. It also happened around the same time my hard drive died and I didn't have enough money to buy a new one. So for about 6 months, I ran entirely off Nopix and a USB memory stick.
We do. It's easy to forget now that every distro seems to have a live version. But for a while, Nopix was the live CD, wasn't it?
There was that, and there was Demo Linux that came out at a similar time, I think. And it might have been based off Nopix as well, I forget.
I think Nopix also was used as a base by quite a few distros.
Yeah,
Nopix was the first one that really worked and had a sensible number of drivers for various things in it. And, you know, actually, you could bearably run a system off the live disk without wanting to smash things after 10 minutes. So yeah, it was really important, and yes, it was used as a model for all sorts of distros that came after it.
And around this time, I'm still nervous when I partition my disk, but back then, like, can you even resize partitions? I can't remember. it was certainly wasn't something you'd want to do.
No.
So if you only had one, and yeah, most people did only have one computer in those days. A lot of people still do now. But there, if you wanted to try Linux, it was quite a big commitment. You know, you're risking all your data. Whereas after it, just whack it in, turn it on, and have a play.
I think that there are a whole list of milestones along the road. That, I mean, one problem for me when I first installed, actually it was BSD. Are we allowed to mention BSD? I installed BSD on an ancient, well, it wasn't ancient at the time, Amiga 4000. And the problem with the, I mean, people complain about the installers now, but then you had a text-based installer that would ask you questions like, what chipset does your serial interface use?
Yeah.
And invariably you'd have to like take the case off your computer and poke around inside it with a torch to read the numbers off the chips. And then you'd pass that question, and then it would ask you some other obscure question about the hardware inside. So it's a wonder anyone actually managed to get any sort of open source operating system installed at all in those early days.
Floyd Patterson mentions Andrew Trigil, the man who developed Samba, allowing interoperability between all Linux OSs and Microsoft. James Corden nominates Edwin Buzz Aldrin. Okay. Dave says, a mention for Greg Crower Hartman for his work on the kernel, yes. And another kernel developer is Alan Cox, who is put forward by Omniferious Implementer. Finn puts forward Bradley M. Kuhn for his work at the Free Software Foundation, Free Software Freedom Law Center, and at Software Freedom Conservancy. And he also mentions the awesome and aforementioned Karen Sandler.
No mentions for Tux.
No mentions for Tux, but then the question was, who is the most important GNU Linux Floss person?
Ah, yes.
And I think being a penguin, you know, that's just a technicality, really. Oh, here's one by Clem, who says, Mr. Mark Shuttleworth for giving us Unity. I think that might be a facetious one. Although, when we were talking...
No, it doesn't sound facetious to me.
It sounds facetious. No.
Well, to be fair,
go on, defend Unity.
I'll defend it, because it's probably the most important thing for Linux Mint was Unity.
Yes, that's true. That's probably why Clem put it forward. I think, in all joshing aside, the question how many Linux users has Unity put off is easy to answer, because people blog about it and rant on Google+ and say, oh, Unity is rubbish, I'm switching to XFCE or whatever. The question how many new Linux users have looked at Unity and decided, yeah, this is great, I don't need to use Windows 8 anymore, is harder to answer, because you're moving from one community into another, and all you know is that this thing is Linux. You might not even know that it's Unity. It's just someone said, oh, try this thing out that's called Ubuntu. So it's very easy to mock it, but if it's not aimed at us, it's not aimed at people who've been using Linux for a long time. And anyway, if we've been using Linux for such a long time, we can uninstall it and put something else in.
Yes, it is completely possible, obviously, to run Ubuntu with a different desktop if you want. But as you say, and I think you were alluding to earlier on, when you mentioned you like things nice and easy, Unity, the goal of Unity is to make things nice and simple for people, and yet retain a level of functionality that you come to expect from a Linux distro, and I think it does that. I think it does that really well. And I think it is even more impressive when you look at the unification across platforms that's happening around Unity with the mobile devices as well. I think that's going to be really important and very interesting. But it's nice that we can have these arguments about desktops now in the Linux market. It's more interesting than arguing about, you know, whether arguing between operating systems, which we used to argue about. Now people argue about what desktop they want to run on Linux.
Well, they're not exactly arguing. I mean, my favourite comment on here is California Penguin responding to the person that posted in front of him saying, "Good point." When do you ever see that on the internet? when do you ever see civilised manners? And you know, after you. No, after you. Oh, that's a good point. Thank you.
We're reclaiming a little portion of the internet for Britain.
For sanity, for good old-fashioned thanks. Let's have a cup of tea and a biscuit and, you know, be awesome to one another. Ray Woods, I think we should probably wrap this up with Ray Woods, who says, the one name that we haven't really spoken about so far, he says, Linus Torvalds. Without him, we would still be waiting for the herd.
Well, we're not waiting for the herd. The herd.
No, the herd is with us. The herd is alive and well. And I tried it a couple of weeks ago. Again, I keep dipping in and out of the herd. And I've got a screenshot of the installer. It's preposterous. It allows you the choice of a text install, a pseudo graphical install, a graphical install, or an expert install. Like, just install the damn system. Don't ask me all these questions.
It's interesting, isn't it? Why, someone who wasn't mentioned and isn't really a FOSS person, I suppose, Grace Hopper. Does anyone know Grace Hopper?
Yes, I know Grace Hopper. Grace Excellent. And I regularly go to barbecues together.
Did you? She invented compiled languages and the compiler, and therefore, you know, without the compiler, I mean, you can go back as far as history allows and pick out people who have been important on the road to open source, and you know, they even predate things like the GPL.
Predating the GPL, surely that's the dawn of time. What were the olden days like, Grandad?
Maybe I'll tell you next time.
that seems to bring things to a nice rounded off conclusion, I think. We've been recording for a decent amount of time. And thanks again to everyone who's visited us and is thinking about buying a subscription to Linux Voice.
I think Bob Geldof said it better, but anyway.
Bob, yes. Yes, he did. I've been channeling an inner Bob Geldof, but passing it into civilised language. we'll see you again later in 2 weeks. So, from me, Andrew Gregory.
From me, Ben Everard.
And from me, Nick Veach.
And from Mike, wherever he may be.
Bless
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. It's such a nice day.